We all know that we have something to do with caskets, and we know that Nesbitt and Manley are the builders. And that's when somebody dies and you hear that they're going to have a homemade casket, well, you know where you're going to be. You're going to be fixing the casket.
This program is about making caskets. Really nothing about death, caskets, funerals, cemeteries are considered to be fit subjects for casual conversation. For instance, if you want to make a poor impression on a first date, you might try discussing, say, the design and construction of caskets. You'll find that people prefer to maintain a considerable distance between themselves and the subject of death, maybe because they want to stay away from death itself. And that, I think, is why I was so impressed when I heard of a few people in a rural Washington community who from time to time have made caskets. Not as a commercial enterprise, but as a gesture of goodwill towards the deceased and towards that person's family and friends. Their first casket was made for Jacob Nordenson, by his stepson, Manley Smith, and by Dave Nesbitt. Their decision to make Jacob's casket had not been planned.
I went up to the house there, and it was when the funeral guys was up there, and he was giving the old lady this spiel about, you know, about, well, now she's got to have this casket and all this and that. And of course, they don't have anything that's, they're not going to be putting you on anything cheap. And I says, excuse me. And he says, yeah. And I says, would you mind if we built our own casket? And he said, no, I wouldn't mind that. And that was the end of it. And he got up and
left.
That
was the beginning of it.
Yeah. So then we went to building it.
First of all, I mean, we didn't know anything, so it was like, okay, how big is he, right? I had you lay down on the sidewalk. He said, well, about my size, a little longer. And we chalked you out on the sidewalk out here. And he said, okay, well, what are we going to make this out of, right? And I said, we talked it over and thought, well, let's go get 2x6 cedar.
Yeah, it was going to be heavy.
2x6 cedar. So we made out this lumber list, and Manley goes into Bellingham to get this, and it's Friday or Saturday, or just right down to the wire to get this material. And he comes out, instead of 2x6 cedar, he comes out with 1x12 redwood.
Yeah.
Scrap that design.
We've never got to be prepared. Mm-hmm. It's inevitable that somebody that wants one of these, or the next of kin usually, that wants one of these, it's usually a couple days or the next day or the day before. Well, the funeral's tomorrow, and so we wind up all night.
Each casket built by Manley Smith, Dave Nesbitt, and their friends is unique. I ask them what they consider when they design a casket.
You get the feeling of that person and of their personality, of how you knew them, you know. And so then you say, well, I think that, you know, this looks like they might like this. Or And then sometimes families have a special thing they would like. We had one recently. They had the wood cut rough sawn out in their woods by a sawmill. Okay, came in with a sawmill, and that's what they wanted it out of. So Dave went up there and loaded it on the truck, you know.
There was a big stack of lumber, and I went through the whole stack, or half the stack, finding the boards I wanted.
But it was family. Family lumber.
There are other design considerations of a more practical sort, such as fitting a handmade coffin into the formal system of mortuaries and cemeteries. One of these is the size of the vault, the concrete lining of the grave.
First thing you think of is your vault size, and they're usually pretty standard, but you got different kinds. Some kind you put together, some kind come in two pieces, and this and that, et cetera. So you have to find out what's going on there first.
And we casted one ourselves.
Right.
So that's the limits of your design. Yeah, and it's real critical because it's really embarrassing when you lower the thing and it doesn't fit.
Does that happen?
It came close once, real close.
Yeah.
We were building one, I don't know whose, but it was out in this garage. In the middle of the night, we were well into this thing, and it dawned on us that it might not fit. And so we asked for volunteers, and two guys went over in the middle of the night with flashlights and climbed into the grave and measured. and came back with those figures, and we had to reduce our handles.
You would think that Murphy's Law, and you all know Murphy's Law, should not apply to the community building of a coffin. Unfortunately, not so.
It's a really good story. I mean, you know, it's like any other thing you do. You get fouled up sometimes. I remember having, I think it was 2 days or 3 days to make one. And it was requested. And the lady that died wanted one. And so I went to making this darn thing, and I measured it all out and it's lot of done. And it was a diamond-shaped thing. So you had, 4 foot sides, and then each end had three corners. And they tipped at the bottom. The bottom ones tipped in, and the top ones tipped in towards the top. And so it was like a diamond with these faces. I got that thing all done. That was all made out of cedar, tongue and groove cedar, and framed in with fir framings, just like a boat, just like you'd build a boat. And we got that thing all done and lined and everything and took it in, and it was too small. They could not get her in it. And the reason was because of the bevels going in. It made it too short. And that's the kind of thing you run into. So that night, the funeral was the next day. That night, I went out and got some rough sawn cedar planking, 1x12, and made another one. It was very simple, and it turned out very beautiful. It was Western red cedar, and it has nice grain, and it came out really nice. It's, you know, something like I should have done in the first place.
The first one was very complex, very many facets, and real delicate with runners, and it looked very something special, and still kicking around this island.
Looked a bit Egyptian on the lake.
Extraordinary.
Dave Nesbitt and Manly Smith showed me pictures of many of the caskets which they have made. I think the most extraordinary of them all was made out of a log for Manly Smith's unborn child.
My wife went for a plane ride when she was 9 months pregnant, and the plane crashed. And subsequently, we lost the kid. Anyway, I went out in the woods with my chainsaw. Here was a huge hunk of maple. I guess it was a windfall or something. And cut a chunk off of it, about 2 feet long, I guess, 2.5 feet long. Split it down the middle and hogged it out with a chainsaw and milled the corners down a little bit, looked like a peanut when it was done, and put some leather straps on it, some old harness. Somebody came along and gave me some of old Man Granger's harness, and we put that on for straps, and that thing looked neat. It looked just like a little chest, you know.
The caskets which they build are far more elaborate and time-consuming than the traditional pine box. The hours are long and the deadline comes quickly.
I haven't stayed awake long enough to see one go in the ground yet.
Yeah, we're pretty rummy by the end, and he's actually missed a number of the funerals.
I miss them. I've missed my stepdad's. I was too tired. I passed out. And
so you worked straight through?
Worked straight through, and I don't know how. I just fall asleep, and I miss them going in the ground. That's how tight it is.
How do you eat?
People bring stuff, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
People good, bring stuff and you're working away.
Back when we were doing a lot of drinking.
We'd drink some.
Well, drink some, too.
That was standard thing. Well, we got to build one, so you get some whiskey and beer and whatever and stay there and go at it.
I asked about the attitudes of the people working on a casket. What is the atmosphere like in the shop when a casket is being made?
It's cheerful. They're not a sad thing to make, really. I mean, we're all going to be using one sometime. And if you making somebody else feel good, too, usually, because it's what they want, you know. So we're usually pretty cheery. I don't think we're...
Oh, usually, yeah. It's almost a party with moments, very sober moments.
Yeah.
I mean, periodically... Either individually or collectively, you stand back and you realize what the heck you're doing, and your friend is going in this forever, and it just knocks you out. But then it goes, and you know, people are coming in with food and things
good.
To drink.
You feel good about what you're doing for that person that you lost, even. It's different than going out and buying one, and you got the procession and all that, and you're not involved, really. You're just standing there, and you watch it happen, and This way, I think you feel like you've done the last thing you can do for that person anyway.
I asked David Manley if it was usually just the two of them who worked on the caskets, or if other people helped as well.
Design-wise, and initial getting it on, getting it going-wise, yeah. But it involves quite a few people, ultimately. When you get to sand, and when you're laying up and building, you can't have too many people, probably. You get fouled up. But as soon as that thing is pretty much together,
roughed in,
boy, then you got people that'll come in and they'll sand it and do this and that, and then ladies get out their talents and start lining it. They just drop by
all day long, all night long,
all day, all night. Bring stuff, and they just want to come and see what it's going to look like.
It's like you're doing it right. Say we're doing it right here. Say there's Manny and me, and there's usually a two sort of seconds that are gluing up and drilling, and so we're working on this thing, and then there'll be just a crowd just standing around and getting things, gophers, you know. Hey, well, we need this, go get that, will you?
What could we use to line it this time? Well, I got a nice set of curtains.
Or somebody had some brown silk for artists. Now, where did that come from? Beautiful. I think,
yeah.
Sandy,
what do you call
the
that?
Canalist, said, I've got some raw silk that she got from somewhere way back, and it was really amazing material.
Very expensive.
Very expensive, stuff. Turns out. And bam, go get it. And she went and got it. It was beautiful. We put it in it.
Yeah, we've used quilts and blankets. And
well, now, what do you want their head to be on? Well, I never thought about that. You know, and they get a pillow.
Their favorite pillow. You put that in there.
Joanne Nordenson, Jacob Nordenson's wife and Manley Smith's mother, has been involved in the lining of several of the caskets. I asked her what goes into the choice of lining material.
Well, like the lady next door, they wanted to fill her casket with hay because she was a little farmer, you know, she always farmed everything. But it ended up that we had a beautiful piece of raw silk, which really suited her. And Jacob's was just a soft corduroy, but Charlotte Nesbitt got together with somebody else and finished a quilt that I had started. And that's what we covered him with this quilt that I had started. And then we took his pillow, you know, his own pillow, covered it with blue fabric, and it just made it very special. It just was, I was in awe of the whole thing, being the first one, you know, to see what, you know, people in a small community do. It was all just homespun, a family island thing. It made me feel good, and it still makes me feel good.
While these people appear to have come on their own to their practice of coffin making, the practice itself has a long tradition. In the Foxfire series, which presents the affairs of rural living of a rural Appalachian community, the people of that community describe what they remember of the making of caskets. Just as there were no funeral parlors, there were also no professional casket makers. That work, like the preparation of the body, was done by friends, relatives, or men in the community who did it either for free or to earn a portion of their living. Harley Thomas, for example, a genuine craftsman, was paid about $35. Others charged about $5 to cover the cost of the handles, and many others simply did it as their contribution to the mourning family. Mr. Mize, the director of a local funeral parlor, said, back in those days, they'd make their own caskets. Neighbors would gather around some carpenters and they'd make the caskets. Mr. Lester Norton's father made the caskets for her community. She said, Parker made as many as 6 caskets for people, and he had his lumber all ready for his own when he died. He already had chosen John Wilbur to make the casket. He asked him to do it before he died. Caskets were made out of poplar, oak, pine, or chestnut. Their shapes varied widely, but usually they were body-shaped, wide at the shoulders and narrow at the feet. Ethel Korn remembers seeing some that had a glass built in through which you could see the body. In Lex Sanders' younger days, however, they were not as elaborate as any of these, being just simple square boxes. Mrs. E.H. Brown went into more detail. They padded the coffin with cotton and lined it with what we call plain white silk. And then they took carpet tacks and tacked that down. It was right pretty. It wasn't painted, it was covered with some kind of black material. My father was buried in a casket like that, and my grandfather was buried in one too, but it was his request that his coffin be made out of undressed lumber. He didn't want it dressed, and so it was made that way. That old man out yonder, and she points to a picture on the wall, he made him. He made nearly everybody's casket. Anna Howard remembered the lumber being dressed with an adze and then covered with a white bleaching. And then sometimes there was little things they put on the coffin, like handles. It was brass and they were shiny. They had them to sell in the stores.
We took this one down to the morticians were in Seattle. I think a Bonnie rest, but that's not it. It's Bonnie something or other. And they do 1,000 funerals a year. And I went into their display room, which was bigger than this room, much bigger. And they had maybe 50 caskets, all different kinds. It seemed to me that the more you paid, the more grotesque they became in a design sense. In fact, you pay an extra $100, $200 and you get handles that have an embossed picture of the Last Supper, that sort of thing. And there's these kind of gross, doobie-ga boxes that I wouldn't put my cat in, you know? They're like silk taffeted doodads that have no place for most people. We just don't live that way.
As you might imagine, most caskets these days come from the showrooms like Dave Nesbitt described. I asked several funeral directors about the frequency of their placing bodies into homemade caskets. The seven directors with whom I spoke had cumulatively over 125 years of experience in their trade. In that 125 years, they'd seen a total of no more than 6 caskets brought to them by the families and friends of the deceased. So it's no surprise that when Patty Helm told the mortician that her neighbors were making her husband's coffin, the mortician was quite surprised.
The man who owns the, what do they call them, funeral homes? He called on the phone and said all those things that people say to you on the phone, oh my dear, and all. You will want to come down and, you know, I don't know what he said, but I got the idea he was saying you will need to come down and choose. And I said, well, no, I won't, because my friends are making Charles's coffin, and when it's done, they'll bring it. I don't remember what he said, except I remember a long pause. He said, making it, and there was a long pause, and then he repeated it, making it, and he said, well, we've never had that done before. We've never had that done. And he said his apprehensions are that this will, many, many, many people will be here, and many of Charles' friends, and he wants to make sure that it would be in keeping with Mr. Helm's place in the community. And it began to trickle through, you know. In other words, they didn't want some homemade-looking thing in his funeral parlor. So I felt I could be honest with him, and I said, I'll make no apologies to anyone. No, this is my husband.
Dave Nesbitt and Manly Smith made their first casket over 10 years ago. I asked if the entire community now supported the effort when there was a call for a homemade coffin.
We've got quite a few different types of people on the island, and when you say, you know, accepted it in the community, that would be false, I'd think. Most people, even here, would prefer a botten box. I don't know why, but I think most of our stuff has been with the older generation, you know, the older people that have been around for years, and maybe their kids, you know, somebody like that. But a lot of the retired people and other folks that moved in when the boom was going, I don't think they're so interested so much.
In fact, there are some people who do not care at all for the community-made coffins.
Yeah, I'm sure there's people who think it's very vulgar.
Vulgar, really?
Oh, yes.
It's pretty strong.
Look around.
Distasteful. Vulgar.
Yes,
yeah,
distasteful.
Okay.
Not right, not proper.
Yeah.
And how could you bury him in that when we have these shiny metal things with water gasket seals and they'll last forever in there and
I don't
be in comfort and 6 inches of foam, and how could you put them in there?
Well, I don't think they would have that attitude if they were to witness that feeling that you have when the thing goes out the door to catch that ferry boat, to go into the funeral home. There's a feeling of kind of a collective effort that's been going on for 3 days, and it builds to a crescendo, that you really have done something for this grieving family and for the deceased. something very special. And admittedly, it's a little weird, but in the process of solving that practical problem, you have this real spirited happening. That's nice.
The caskets these folks build really are quite impressive pieces of work, representing hundreds of dollars worth of materials and scores of hours of careful workmanship. I wondered how the builders felt to see all of their work buried under 6 feet of dirt to decay along with the body.
Oh, I think it's great. I didn't even think about it. I haven't ever even given it a thought after it was done. You know, I'm glad it's done.
Well, it's like when we were doing Artie's and her sister came up and everybody was kind of getting tired of doing it or something. I don't know, the mood was all of a sudden different. We were putting the lining in, and we were really trying to do a good job of putting the lining in, and Dot says, well, don't worry, you don't have to do it that good. It's just, the cover's just going to be shut, and it's going to be stuck in the ground. And I was like, but it's Artie's going to be in there, you know? We've got to do this right. I never thought of it being in the ground shut
either, and
rotting away. I've never thought of it as that. What happens to steel caskets? They get rusty?
I don't know, and they're making them out of plastic, too. I just assume think that
it
went back to Earth
or
that you were making an earthy thing, that it was part of your atmosphere and part of the wood, part of whatever existed around you. I'd rather have it that way.
There's a pleasure about doing the best you can do and designing something just real nice and executing it, you know, with making the bottom as nice as the top and nothing phony about it, and doing as good a job with the whole thing. And then burying it forever, or something, kind of makes it that much more important, the fact that it's very short-lived.
You know you're going to die, you know everybody's going to die, and there's a certain speck of joy in it, rather than going out and buying a casket, making one, and making it, like Dave says, the best you can, just really nice, you know, just make all the joinery really nice on it, and it's just so temporary, but you get a joy out of death, you know.
The gallery, especially with an older person, is
just
a good feeling, a good healthy feeling.
It's not that cold.
And here it is, somebody's died, and you just get a good feeling about it. Something that it's actually a subject that people don't talk about a lot, especially younger people. Kind of a void, you know?
And a lot more personal. It's a lot more personal.
Not so frightening.
Not so cold, and it's not so final.
I asked Dave Nesbitt what he thought about when it was all over, the casket finished, filled, and buried.
I do recall after the funeral, after the burial, and actually shoveling the dirt in and finishing it off after everybody left, walking back up to where I was working the same day after the funeral. And realizing that, wow, you know, there, but sort of for the grace of God, I'm walking back to work and he's 6 feet down. And the week before I'd been working on his house. It was all a go. Just sort of how it always affects me. It makes me think about my life, how temporary it is and fragile all of ours are.
As far as we know, the occupant of a casket doesn't know anything of the casket in which he or she is buried. But to the friends and family left behind, to at least a few people in this rural Washington community, these homemade caskets mean a great deal. I asked Patty Helm if her feelings towards her neighbors had changed as a result of the casket which was made for her husband.
Just to underline what I already know about here, about where I live and why I live here, I came here because I hoped that this is the kind of a place it would be. And it is. And it takes a lot of work, of this kind of work, that's hard work for people to do together to make it that kind of a place. But it just reiterated and underlined what I already know, that Dave's my neighbor. When I called him, I hated to ask him to do it because I know what he goes through when he does this each time. You know, 3 days and three nights or 2 days and two nights. And they were all there, you know, when I needed them the most.
You may have noticed that throughout this program, the name of the community where people build coffins has been omitted. This was their request. These people enjoy their privacy. The builders do not wish a flood of orders. Their casket making is not a business. So if a homemade casket is something you want for a family member, a friend, or even for yourself, you'll have to make it yourself. No funeral director with whom I spoke expressed any reservations about homemade caskets. They're not against the law, neither making them nor using them. Just make them strong, they said, and attach the handles well. A flimsy casket might cause injury to a casket bearer, and of course considerable embarrassment to the casket builder. My thanks to Dave Nesbitt, Manly Smith, Joanne Nordenson, and Corky Nordenson, and my name is Phil Andrus.